Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 9 continues. John now relaxed. He felt that the whole problem had wobbled back into safety, like a blind person caught by the arm at the edge of a chasm. The supervisor repeated, "Speeches! Good God, what I wouldn't do not to give a talk." "I know," John said. "Me too. Peter is very different from you and from me, both." "Keep talking," his supervisor said. "This may sound nuts, but I think it's sound. The man loves virtue and he practices a lot of it." "Be sure not to describe it, any of it to me," the other grinned. "I hate virtue. It causes more plain, outright cruelty than any other Boy Scout thing around." John Rubric smiled lightly. "I think you're right, but there's a kink in Peter Tenebrae's liking for virtue. He likes virtue so much that he believes everyone has a good deal of basic virtue in them. He literally believes that. One of those people who basically thinks Hitler would have been okay if he had just gone to a Rudolf Steiner school and not got so many beatings from his dad. Tenebrae really does think that all the bad folks need is to have a chance to develop a taste for the res publica and they will respond and become noble men. That's what he thinks. Example, he thinks he and his wife are working on her alcoholism and making progress. Working on her drinking problem. Jesus, his supervisor said appreciatively. John went on. Old Peter also has had good cash flow all his life, so it doesn't really occur to him that a lot of people do what they do because they have to get their hands on some money within a given period of time. That never crosses his mind. If you told him that's how people live, scraping along from crisis to crisis, he'd look pained. He'd say, "Boy, I so much hope you're wrong about that, John." Whenever I tell him any bad news of why people do what they do, he looks at me as if I were quoting from Wikipedia. "This genuine belief in virtue now," John's supervisor said, "I'm glad I don't see more of it than I have to. It makes me nervous. It can be very hard to read. Very hard to get a bead on. Well, so where's all this going?" the supervisor said. "I feel kind of stuffed into a Sunday school. I want out." John leaned forward. "When Peter Tenebrae takes on a whitewash, he believes that he can present that company's interests in the light of that company's good intentions and potential good behavior. He sees himself as a sort of God-given defense attorney for a serial killer who, he believes, did not mean to hurt anyone. That's his view." The supervisor had looked ready to sneer, but now his expression steadied. "Christ," he said quietly. "Bring you fellows anything?" their waitress said, hovering. "More coffee, if you would," John's supervisor said. John said, "I'd keep Tenebrae. Don't worry. If he suddenly listens to a critical mass of what his little circle of young people try to tell him, so any of it sinks in, that will be time enough to take steps." The supervisor said, "Okay, I will think about it some more. I have begun thinking about this." "Oh, do I know about that?" Instead of replying, his supervisor said, "You had some further point you were going to make. Why we should keep him on." John said, "Yes, it's the basic logic behind how Peter works. The reason he is such good whitewash is that he can't distinguish bad from good. He never sees evil, so to speak. Excuse the Sunday school language. Let's say he seldom has any concerns because he always feels that anything wrong anywhere is a temporary glitch. If you give it some effort and are personable to everyone involved, everybody will join at some level to make things work out." The older man said, with his lion cynical face, kept stirring his coffee, "Sounds like a nun." He looked up at the waitress who had returned. "That's the best coffee I've had in a long time." "Thank you, sir." The supervisor said, "Okay, John, I am going with your proposal. Tenebrae stays on the long leash. I'm going to assume that no little silvery snail trail will lead from this Vern Denham quitting thing to Peter Tenebrae to you, and from me to you, from me to the others, to our team. I am going to assume that. It'll be fine, John said. I wonder if you can do me a favor. God, this is horrible coffee. Us and the Chinese, we make terrible coffee somehow. What's the favor you want? John said, I have been trying to get Peter some speaking engagements in New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts. Those are his favorite places. I've dropped the idea to various people, but I haven't been able to make anything happen so far. Could you get a couple of speeches? Then I will tell him about them, and he'll be glad. The supervisor smiled and said, what do you want me to do that you haven't already wrangled? His old school say, here's three kinds of things I'd like to get him. I would like to get him a respite sermon for some already overworked interim pastor in New Hampshire, or some beautiful place like that. You know, the white spire and the nice people he'd relate to, old New England types. I'd like to get him the sermon for some Sunday, to say January or February, when the interim minister would want to take off skiing with friends. Second, maybe this is too much to ask, could you get him a kind of community life sermon, you know, from the point of view of a businessman at Peter Brook's house? Peter was a Harvard man. He would love it. And finally, do you know anybody at Andover who would put Peter on a visiting committee of some sort? So maybe he could piggyback a Sunday talk in the chapel there. I have been looking at a pile of old Andover bulletins from around the time of Peter's class, trying to figure out if any of those classmates were active in the Alumni Association could be called to include Peter for any reason. I haven't got any real handle there at all. A very familiar look came over John's supervisor's face. It was an expression John knew well. He had even used such a look himself. The look said, you have just asked me a question that calls for senior statesmanship, which I have, and I can, and I will help you. I have what it is that you're needing but can't do, and I am about to offer it. I am offering it in the spirit of congeniality. It suggested, be grateful, but it also said, I am a nice person, and I am genuinely happy to do you a favor. Aloud, the other man said, I'll poke around. I know I can give you the Andover visit more or less immediately. I think there won't be any trouble about the church. Unitarian be okay? Or does it have to be Episcopalian or UCC or something? I'll get back to you on your cell this afternoon so you can tell him tonight at dinner. We did agree, didn't you? You're caging dinner off him tonight? You can even say you expect to hear from the Phillips Brooks people. We will either get him that or we won't in the next few days. John smiled appreciatively. That's fast, he said. The supervisor said, it's good you got yourself invited to dinner because you need to talk to him before young Denham gets there. If he's invited and loads up with liquor so he can tell Peter he's quit the nice job Peter got him. That Peter is a rolling stone of an idealist. He is always quitting some job because it's too dirty for him. That man is a rolling stone of an idealist. He is always quitting some job because it's too dirty for him. John now realized that his supervisor had not only known that the rack quitter was Fern Denham, but he had already vetted him. The supervisor continued, Denham might decide to show up at Tenebrae's and tell all about rack chemical. Here's the ideal case. The ideal case is, you talk to Peter before he talks to Denham. Second part, the number one outcome is Peter makes it clear to Denham that Denham needs to keep his mouth absolutely shut about rack just for now, because Peter, old fatherly type that he is, virtuous community leader, means to handle this appalling inhumane practice at Five Lab at a very high level, powerful activist in Washington. And finally, the ideal case is Peter promises that he will keep Denham in the picture as the gratifying results start coming through, but it means Denham shuts his mouth for now. Tenebrae expresses gratitude to Denham, both for being observant and for having a wonderful moral maturity. But he says to Denham, absolutely leave it to me. Once he gets all that through Denham's head, then Denham can load up on scotch with the other dinner party guests, but keep his mouth shut. My experience is that once people have decided they are going to do some serious drinking and keep their mouths shut, they feel all geared up with nowhere to go. So they look around for some girl at the party and try to make out instead. Maybe that is tonight's best option for Denham. This plan strike you okay? He felt as if the devil had come up to him and said, "Listen, I dyed my horns a brighter red today. Do you think this shade's okay?" "What's your cell phone number?" John scribbled his cell phone number onto a deposit slip and held it above their stained cups and saucers. The supervisor leaned forward and read it aloud, without taking it out of John's hands, and said, "Okay, you haven't changed it." Then he reared up a little to signal the waitress for the bill. Outside, the snow fell more harshly. It ticked onto the senior man's Mackenzie plaid golf cap, a favorite choice of businessmen going bald. For just a second, John's supervisor looked like an impressionist painting of a pudgy-faced man swinging along on a Midwestern sidewalk. "American in a snowfall," thought John. "That's what Pissarro would have called it," thought John. He took the back roads to Eveleth. The moment he got onto 53 in Eveleth, his cell phone went off. He picked up the receiver. "Good news," the supervisor's voice said thickly, because he too was in a car. "Better than I expected. I got you all three talks." "Two firm, one tentative," he described the speeches. "Perfect," John said. They talked over the contact people and addresses, and John felt cheered. He would make a point of getting to Peter's very early, say at 5. He visualized asking Peter to set down the mixing bowl, or whatever he would be doing for dinner, and give him an even 10 minutes in his study. He visualized Peter's delight. Snow closed in around him. He could barely make out the vague swamp pine forest at either side of his route. But enough other people were driving along the highway in both directions, so they kept blowing the road clear. The surface was safe enough for as long as he needed it. Chapter 10. George and Mercy and Herzlick had had a horrible fight over something stupid. George thought, why weren't they fighting about sex or money or how the aging parents of one were selfish whereas the other one's aging parents weren't? That was the kind of thing normal couples fought about, but not he and Mercine. He and Mercine were fighting over her knitting because she was always knitting something for the priest, and George took that priest to be the most complacent fool in the world. 3-day fight or no 3-day fight, George got over to the auto lot at his usual time on Wednesday morning. Today, Stan looked gathered and up for the day. He always got down to the dealership very early. He would be eating a deli sandwich in his office and reading over mail until George or Kenny showed up. These days, George sometimes found him lying propped up on Silver's couch, either asleep or awake with the worsening black half-circles under his eyes and a translucence to his skin. Today, Stan's expression was merely practical. He was picking off any number of Silver's hair from his jacket cuffs. George was relieved because he had such bad feelings of his own. He didn't want to feel even sadder about Stan. Not here in the man's presence. Stan asked George to get Mercine and would the two of them drive the Impala up to its new owner and cook as soon as Kenny got it washed. Stan would come along in an hour and meet them at the Montana and buy lunch. For a couple of years, that restaurant had gone partly yuppie, adding bad breath, art food, and sandwiches from which hummus and bean sprouts leaked onto your Garris Otto's jacket. At last, the owner seemed to swing back to solid, regular food. They made hamburgers with 1/3 instead of 1/4 pound of ground sirloin in them, and they'd grilled the buns on the same beef greasy stove. Any lunch there was delicious. The coffee was not so black, it reamed out your stomach. George said, "We could start right now, and I'll swing around to that natural wool sheep outlet up there that Mercine likes so much." George had two nervous-making subjects on his mind. First, the usual one. He really should look around for a better position than Stan Garris's business offered. He forever turned that problem over in his mind like an old dog with an old tasteless bone. It seemed to him that each day Stan looked sicker. George decided not to show any of the fear that he felt. He didn't want Stan to die. He also partly wanted to quit and get another position in a bigger town. But he couldn't ditch a dying man. He could tell Stan already regarded their friendship as holy. That is, Stan's upcoming death was making things seem holy to Stan. George could tell by how he talked. Then the dog was stolen. Just now Stan didn't need to have his only employee with an IQ over 100 up and leave him. The other subject was worse. Though he and Mersenne had quarreled over 3 days ago, she was still scarcely speaking to him. The quarrel hung all around them. They went down under its gloom. They moved around each other like rats in a crawl space. It was all George could do to get the smallest household tasks done. Kept trying to clear up the quarrel, at breakfast, at supper, at breakfast again, and supper, but Mersenne wouldn't talk to him. She just kept her dining room chair pushed away from the table so that her knitting wouldn't get egg smeared onto it. Whenever George tried to speak, she said, "If you're through eating, you can be excused." He hadn't heard that since they were raising the children. Now he felt that if he could get into a car with her, hock it out in the hour and a half to cook, it would be winter driving, dull white sky. There was nothing to look at, so she couldn't just pretending to look out the window. He wondered if she'd bring that damned knitting with her. He couldn't prevent that, but he could make her talk at last. He had been faithful. He did not regret it either. Mersenne always, always got to him some way. She still did, even when she was being a pest like in these last 3 days. She did not double-cross the children by talking about them at coffee clutches. She did not double-cross George or do a sidewinder act at New Year's Eve parties where husbands and wives, for some reason, would let loose with a lot of mean comments, all feathered back, of course, to sound like, "Hey, just kidding." Mersenne loved their children. That wasn't supposed to be unusual in a mother, but the fact was, George had seen a lot of women go straight gimlet-eyed when their kids came up and asked for something. The kids felt it. George felt it. Thanksgiving wasn't the pathetic sham at their house that other families suffered through. When it was Mersenne's turn to have them, the relations, for Thanksgiving, it was a bright-hearted, like a TV sitcom ad for Thanksgiving. George was proud of himself, too. He made money without being a sleaze. Once he got a potential used car buyer out into the back lot, George would sell him the best the fellow could pay for. True, he made good use of the varmint, but that didn't hurt anybody. The varmint was a still good-looking, no-rust Volvo that George and Stan kept parked at the north edge of the slab. Next to the varmint, when he could, George parked one or another GM vehicle of the same year. Or if they happened to have one in, a Volvo, that looked older than the varmint. He and Stan had Kenny move all the cars around every other day or so, so that any regular gawker in St. Fursey had 10 or 11 of those, even in a hard winter, would get the sense that Garris's dealership kept turning over its used cars. If a genuine customer was looking at anything near the varmint, George would make sure they saw it. If they paused to eye it, George would say, "Yes, I know that Volvo is a wonderful-looking car. You don't want that car. The catalytic converter is shot. Someone might repair it, but I doubt it. It's a compactor." George left it to Stan, his proprietor, to do the major sweetening around the community. He left it to Stan to drop around at Big Shot's shops and offices, even to drive up to that fancy think tank resort north of town. Mysterious, high-end people, that was for Stan, not George. One of George's particular specialties was knowing which kids in town did good body work and rust removal and painting, and which kids in town did good desktop promoting of their body work and their rust removal and their painting. He tried not to offend any of these kids, because they were the people who didn't leave St. Fursey right after high school. The familiar pattern was a couple of boys would get someone's corrugated shed and believe in themselves for 2 years. They believed they would make money. Few of them could, but once they had stayed 2 years in St. Fursey after high school, they tended to stay the rest of their lives. Eventually, they would do business with George, because those poor guys were down to trying to find happiness in driving a nice car. People who failed in automotive, especially in bodywork, bought more cars in a 20-year period than richer men who didn't know a tire from a donut. Actually, these young men loved cars. George waited for them. One of George's side jobs was keeping crooked mechanics out on their own from clipping reliable Garris Auto's customers. Each year, the number of crooks grew. George stayed on tiptoe. It was easy enough to spot poor auto repair itself. What was a challenge was to figure out which of these sleaze mechanics would subcontract out little jobs George might give them to their incompetent, lazy, or meth-tweaking friends. It was a constant surprise to George how some really good worker, who had actually got signed off on onboard diagnostics or transfer cases at a real school, would think he had to do a favor for a slob friend. So George steered his used car customers to the good kids. The bad kids sometimes came to Garasato's lot to beg outright. They would arrive in their matched work clothes, light khaki shirts and pants, and offer George the latest cards they'd had printed up. Before silver got stolen, they would praise her. They would approach her sofa with soft expressions. Silver, however, loved only three or four in all, so she would lay her ears flat back and wait. "Yeah, well, nice girl," the young cons would say and back off before she went for their fingers. "Yeah, but George, I mean Mr. Herslick," one of them said the last time, "how about you give our card to some people you sell inventory to?" "No, you guys, no, no, no," George said. "Not just because you told Imogen Tenebrae she had a faulty windshield when she didn't, and you charged her to replace it with a new one, when all she needed was for you to press around the edges to refirm the bond on the perfectly good one she had. And how do I know you bought her a new one? You probably just left her as in and charged her for a new one after you pressed around the bond of the one she had. Not just that. You tried to sell Walt Steinsider two resonated pipes in the same year. It's a wonder he didn't flatten you. I'll say this for you guys, you're brave enough. Do you have any idea what would happen to you if a 300-pounder like Walt decided he was irritated with you?" George sometimes told Mercine his adventures with crooks. She had a very satisfactory hatred of criminality. She would pretend to be shocked. How could those boys have turned out so bad when she had known their mothers back when in Christian Mothers or CCD? She would press George for all the details. She had a sparkle to her when she was disgusted. All cute women had a causticness about them, George thought. They were not zombies who talked out of eight sides of their mouths. But now he and Mercine had quarreled in such a stupid way. He felt galled that only he, not she, seemed to be oppressed by it. Perhaps he was galled because he was the one who had started it. They had been sitting at breakfast. He said, "Honey, is that another chasuble for Father?" She laid down the lugubrious dark green knitting. Her eyes got motionless and bright. He said, "All that knitting for Father makes me feel stupid." That was all he had said. Was that so bad? She pointed out in a practical tone that she had knit him, George, so many sweaters and Fair Isle vests and set stall koftis and Icelandic windbreakers and Turkish three and knitted ethnic socks that there wasn't anything more she could knit for him. She had knit four sweaters, each for their boys who now lived all over the United States. She had knit baby blankets for all sorts of Christian mothers' groups whom she didn't even like very well. She had fitted out all her and George's grandchildren with buntings and blankets and toddler sweaters. Was he saying, she asked, that he was jealous, jealous of their priest? All because she wanted to see if a chasuble could be knitted at all? Perhaps chasubles had to be woven because they were so heavy. George repeated, "It's only that it makes me feel stupid." But then he made a second mistake. He explained that there were two sorry muddles a man didn't want in his wife. First, no one wanted their wife to fall in love with the doctor who attended the birth of her first child. And second, no one wanted their wife to hang around whoever the current pastor was. It made George's skin crawl just thinking about it. She looked up when he said that about his skin crawling. He allowed it was probably a mistake to mention that. Mercine then gave him a perfectly balanced look, straight and cold, like old weight scales in a hardware. She rose with huge dignity. She went outdoors to lay their climbing rose into its trench for the winter. George watched from the dining room window while she competently dumped spadeful after spadeful of dirt on top of the thorns and leaves. At their next meal, he tried to apologize, but Mersenne said she didn't care to hear whatever it was he thought he was going to say. She went on with that chasuble. The damn thing was in green, too, meaning she'd been carefully thinking ahead and was allowing herself enough time before Trinity season when the church color would be green. He thought she'd chosen a remarkably dirty green, too. Damn clumsy thing looked like the shelter half his dad had been issued in the army. They weren't even in Advent yet, which meant that the dark, muck-green pile was going to be around his house, bloused up on one or another chair seat for months. The worst aspect of it all was that she wasn't knitting miserably. She was happy. He couldn't get through to her. Yesterday, then, when they were beginning their fourth supper in silence, he flung at her. If you ask me, you're too old to still be working with Christian mothers. He had counted on her bursting into tears at such blaring cruelty. Mersenne gave a disdainful glance at his uneaten supper and remarked, I'll bring your dessert. She had been knitting with her chair pushed back from the kitchen snack table. She laid aside her currant skein and the bulky chasuble. She brought out a single piece of chess pie from the refrigerator. I had better put some ice cream on it, she said, as if she were offering to take care of a mistake some puppy had made on the carpet. That was yesterday, damn it. Today, George Dow told himself, we will have to talk to each other on this car ride.
You've been listening to episode 12 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half. The piano music filling out these Shelter Half episodes is performed by Robert Ellis, our reader Connie Ellis's husband, from his CD, Moonrise.